I have to say, my parents were very important to me, and I didn't know either of my grandfathers because they were killed in World War One, but I knew both my grandmothers. So I've got this whole kind of thing, like most of us, we have this kind of antecedents that we know all about. I wonder what it was like for people who don't know who their antecedents were. And we've had this whole story, of course, about adoption where people are entitled to know. But what about people whose biological parents might have been sperm donors? Well, my guest is Dr. Joanna Rose, campaigner for those people. You're a campaigner, of course, because your father was a sperm donor.
Yeah, because I've lived with the anonymity of half my genetic paternal background.
Don't sperm donors normally request anonymity anyway, don't they?
I don't think they're given much choice.
Yeah. Okay.
Generally speaking, there's a notion that people who donate sperm desperately want to donate their sperm and they desperately want anonymity. And I think that's more of the idea of the industry itself that looks for people, targets people to donate their sperm or eggs and does that under the premise of anonymity or assures them of that. So it's more of, I don't think it's their agenda necessarily. And I've certainly met many people who have been donors who've regretted the fact that they're having trouble having contact with the children that they've produced.
Now, if I look at this personally just for a moment, and I'd be interesting therefore to have your reaction, I would donate sperm, I think, in the same way that I might donate blood, you know, that you would sort of give it and think, well, this is going to save somebody or whatever. But then I wouldn't, I think, because I've never done it, but I don't think that I'd like somebody to come along 20 years later who I'd never seen said, who says to me, hello, Dad.
Well, I read a book by a guy called Dr. Michael Beeney.
Okay.
Who was a man who donated sperm at the clinic at the time and place of my conception. And he thought exactly the same thing. He thought of it as akin to blood donation. And I think a lot of people are encouraged to think of it in that way. In England, the Minister for Health has previously stated that people should consider it as akin to blood donation. But of course it's not. When you donate your blood, you don't create a person that carries your features. When you donate your sperm or your eggs, that child looks no more or less like you or your genetic child than any other child that you'll produce. But it's quite different.
Right. But isn't it, because you're a doctor, but a PhD, and you did a PhD thesis on this very topic. So isn't there a legal minefield here? So the hypothetical case I talked about of me donating sperm. Now, one thing about somebody coming up and saying, hello, Dad. But then what about, does somebody have rights to come up to me and say, well, you have to pay for my university education because you're my father?
I'll kind of refer you to a little story, if you'll
please
bear with
do.
Me.
No, please do.
There's a law that's been created called Norell's Law in Victoria in Australia. And that's overturned anonymity retrospectively. And people have strong emotive responses to that concept. But the reason for that is because one of my best friends, Narelle Geesh, died at 31 because she didn't have access to her medical history. And she thought she had irritable bowel syndrome. And she ended up dying of stage 4 cancer. And she actually had 8 half-siblings in different families that were predisposed to the same cancer that came from her genetic donor that couldn't be told. So it's as a result of those legislators witnessing the death of a woman who'd campaigned for so many years to find her genetic father that that law overturned anonymity retrospectively. And the sad thing is that they also allowed her to meet her genetic father 6 weeks before she died, and he loved her. He was gutted that she spent so many years trying to contact him. And obviously, I mean, for me, I don't use the word dad. The man who raised me, I use the word dad for the man who raised me and father for the man who's my genetic father. And I tend not to mix those
because
notions.
Because it's important, again, for people to listen and listening in terms of your story, because obviously there was a woman who was conceived by a donor. And then, but she had a husband who obviously couldn't make her conceive. But that when you were then born, that was your father. And
well, it was the person.
He was your dad. I think
he was my dad.
It's interesting the way you split them. Actually, it's very good.
Well, they are split.
I like it.
And
I
it's not my
like
choice.
It, yeah.
You
no,
know,
I like it.
But I need to go back to your point about the anonymity just for one moment, because I want people to understand that even if anonymity is overturned retrospectively, you might have a right to have a name and to have knowledge of who your genetic parent is or isn't, but that doesn't mean you have the right to harass them. There's laws in place that say that you can't do that. But ultimately, making that kind of alienation between a genetic parent and child by fortifying it with names like donor and laws and whatever is inherently part of what the problem of the practice is.
When you having gone through this, you wouldn't exist today were it not for the science that created that we could have donors. Prior to that, childless women were childless women, and then science came along and gave them the wonderful opportunity to carry a child, and ultimately a child was born. So there are all those benefits to
it. I've got to be honest, this is not really very scientific. I mean, what happens in terms of donor conception, I won't go into the details, but it's not very scientific. It takes the sperm of an anonymous man and places it in a woman, and they don't have to look at each other or touch each other. But ultimately, there's nothing terribly clever about that.
Okay. So let's go back a step, because you're a campaigner. What does a campaigner do? I mean, what's your campaign?
Well, I've had a High Court test case in the UK, which initially I had a 7-year battle with my own government, the Department of Health and the HFEA. And they argued that basically we have no right to know our genetic identity at all. And I was saying, well, at least we should have parity with adoptees.
I just going to say,
Well, in 1975, adoptees were given retrospective rights to information about their identity. Anonymity was overturned retrospectively, but from that time onwards, they did the same thing, you know, in terms of creating people and saying, oh, all you need is love, but not allowing them knowledge about their own genetic backgrounds.
You see, I approach this topic sort of very ignorantly, really. I mean, there is this theory that I should read about 6 encyclopedias about it before I meet you. But it's not about me being an expert in this. It's about you being an expert. And I wanted to hear your story. And it's interesting, as you talked, my understanding of it, and more importantly, my empathy with your campaign is growing, because as you were talking, and before you said it, I said, we all fought on the adoption issue. We all thought it was wrong that adopted children should not know who their parents were. And yet we have a different view here.
Yeah. And for my PhD, I looked also at the Australian Stolen Generations. So I looked at different cases where a certain group of people are targeted and told that their genetic family is irrelevant for one reason or another. And basically, you know, we have similarities with different groups, adoptees, stolen generations, child migrants. There's all different people around the world where this has happened. And basically, this is the same thing in a new guise. It's for a reason that is not child protection. It's for child production.
Okay, can I ask this question, if you don't mind? Because I wanted to follow through when you talked about the lady who died of stage 4 cancer. When every year that goes by, we're learning more and more about DNA. I mean, they're going to tell us they'll be able to wipe out MS or all sorts of stuff in a few years by knowledge of DNA. How much do you know about the sort of scientific aspect of the sperm that was donated? I mean, because we do know that there are genetic transfers.
Yeah.
I mean, the colour of your eyes or whatever are part of that genetic transfer.
I mean, I know nothing. I know nothing. And for me, what really has hit me hard is for my children. I'm more relaxed about my own welfare for some reason. But when it comes to my children...
Well, tell me about your children.
When in various situations where I've had to take them to paediatricians or GPs, and I've been asked, do they have a predisposition for this in their medical history? And I can't tell you how I feel, that I know that this was a situation. The fact that I don't know that, you know, my son is having issues with his heart now. So he's going to have a 24-hour ECT machine on him for a while. And when I see the pediatrician, they're saying, is there a family history of heart problems? I don't know. And doctors create...
How do they react when you say...
I look at them every time, think, I wonder if you were a sperm donor, because lots of medical students were. So often when I'm speaking to doctors in particular, I check for eye contact and see how they react when I say, I don't know. And I hope for empathy in terms of the fact that that was an intentional, it was a pre-designed thing. It's not an accident. Oh, I wasn't conceived from a one-night stand. And, you know, back to your question, if you wouldn't be here if it weren't for it, you know, there are all sorts of ways to produce people and it doesn't affect their validity or as a human being. You know, I don't agree with the way I was produced. I don't think you should facilitate conception between strangers. I don't think it's a miraculous science. Right. I think it's a sad intervention. But ultimately, I've got friends in the adoption world who are conceived from rape. They don't have to campaign for rape. I've got friends who've been conceived from affairs or from incest. They don't have to campaign for those things. In the same way, just because I'm conceived by this doesn't mean I in any way have to or should support it.
All right. My guest is... Joanna Rose, who is a campaigner on the issue. I mean, well, you've heard Joanna so powerfully talk about being conceived by sperm donation, but you don't agree with it, okay? Can I, if you don't mind, pose a kind of hypothetical question? Because you were conceived, we know that, by sperm donation. Mm. Would you be happier, do you think, today if it was almost like an identity parade in a police lineup and they had six guys in there and they arbitrarily chose one and said, you go in there and have intercourse with that lady to produce a child? I mean, what's a better way? I'm wondering, is there a better way?
I don't think there's a quick fix for infertility in this way.
Absolutely.
You know, to be honest, and that's a sad thing. And I think the reason why people have come up with the ideas, I mean, I'm not denying there's a lot of money in it. You know, I really don't think we can underestimate how much money is in it. But at the same time, I think there is an empathy. And I understand why people would want to help in that situation. I get it. I get how beautiful it is to have my own children. It's a wonderful thing. But it helps that I know their father.
No, thanks very much. But I've got a really nice friend, and this lovely lady, five times tried to have a child by sperm donation. And they spent an awful lot of money, and you know how much money is involved, on five attempts. And at the fifth attempt, she became pregnant and have a child. And this husband and wife have this child they adore, and their life is better as a result of that. Now, they haven't, well, I don't know, in their private moments they well have, but we don't know how, that child is very young. We don't know how that child's going to feel when that child is your age, and or when they have their first visit to the pediatrician and he says...
What's your medical history? Yeah, and I think that's the sad thing is that, you know, this is seen as successful because people take a child home. And on the one hand, you can see how people think, oh, happy story, case closed. But of the people that I know who are donor conceived, the real exploration of what that means for them happens in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, I'm 70s, sure. 80s. And it's actually for those people who, you know, a large percentage are lied to. So there's all sorts of people who are doing gene testing kits who are suddenly finding out through ftDNA or Ancestry that they're half Jewish and they had no idea or whatever. So there's a lot of people that are being hit, you know, like a bombshell hit. Some people are told, and they're told a kind of simplistic story, a bit like baking a cake. You take, you know, an egg from here and then maybe some sperm from here and you put it in an oven from here. That's the gestational mother. And then you have a cake. So there's these very simplistic stories for children about how wanted they were and they just needed a seed from somewhere else. But ultimately, once we reach adulthood, at least a serious percentage of us looks at it differently. Okay. And actually finding out that you've got... tens, 20s, 30s, 40s, hundreds, maybe in some cases thousands of half-siblings in different families, is really complex. And trying to have contact with a genetic, first-degree genetic relative like your own father or sibling, half-sibling, is emotionally a big deal.
But just explain this half-sibling thing you're talking about. What you're saying is that the donor may have given six donations in a row.
Well, in my case, I know that there was a handful of medical students who donated up and down Harley Street, and they called it cornering the market. And in that case, it's highly likely I have between 200 to 300 half-brothers and sisters. The guy, Michael Beeney, who wrote the book, he was one of that handful of students who then reflected on it differently, you know, admitted as much. So what is presented as a simple, clean treatment, once offspring like me start coming forward, you know, I know donor offspring who found that the gynecologist themselves was the man who donated. You know, I know people with schizophrenia, their genetic fathers had schizophrenia in America, and their parents were paid to donate, their genetic people were paid to donate, and they lied about their medical history or they lie about their IQ. It's not as squeaky clean as people make out.
You worry me greatly, I must say.
Well, I'm worried greatly by this practice.
I'm so glad you came in, because I feel so enlightened, and I feel so ignorant about 10 minutes ago. I'm appalled by my ignorance about 10 minutes ago and what you've done for me. Honestly, I'd like to thank you. It's very important. I'll think about this very differently for
the rest
of my life. You're a wonderful campaign. You're a great advocate, and not to mention a great radio interviewee. My guest is Dr. Joanna Rose, campaigner for all those children born of unknown sperm donation. Thanks so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.